So I read an article this week that was dealing with the popularity of different books. And it basically gave a list of the top 10 most read books in the last 50 years. And the list was based on how many books had been sold. And so it wasn't like how many had been done in a print run. It was how many had actually been sold, because they assumed that if they had been sold, then they had actually been read. And it was a pretty interesting list. It would not surprise you what the number one book was. Anyone want to take a crack at it? It was the Bible. That's right. The Bible had sold in the last 50 years 3.9 billion copies, okay? And then number two was a book by Mao Zedong. Number three, which has been around for over the 50-year period that was measured. Number three was the one that blew me away. You know what the third book was on the top books in the last 50 years? The third most sold book. Anybody want to take a crack at it? Harry Potter. That's right. It was Harry Potter. And I have to tell you, in our house, we loved us some Harry Potter. We were all over Harry Potter. They've only been out for, think about this, they've only been out for 15 of these 50 years, okay? And so they've already outsold Tolkien. Tolkien was right behind Harry Potter, okay? And he's been out there for the entire 50-year increment. So it was pretty interesting to see the list. And so I just kept thinking back to how when Jeff read the first book 15 years ago, and he was like, this is pretty good. And then I was like, well, I'm not reading them. They're children's books. And we went to the first movie, and I was like, I am in. This is the most fun I've had in a long time. And so despite the fact that people were concerned that we were going to turn into a witch and a warlock if we read the books, we soldiered on. And by the time our kids were old enough to read them, we had read everything that had been out thus far, and we were ready to have whatever conversations we needed to have with them. But we loved them. And our children loved them. And by the time the last book came out, our entire family was waiting for Amazon to drop the box. We call UPS Brown Santa. And we were just waiting. Brown Santa, Brown Santa, Brown Santa. And here came the truck, and we were all waiting. And we let Mary Kate read the book first, because she had kind of a thing for Harry at the time. And we felt like that was only fair. We had one copy. And she literally took it into the guest room, and she holed up with it. And I don't think she bathed or ate for a day and a half. And as soon as she was done, she came out and handed it off, and the next person got it. And my son Matt got it. I can't remember what order he was, but I was supposed to be last. And he gets a hold of the book, and he would go to school, and I'd be like, you can't read at school. You got to leave it here. And then the whole time he'd be at school, I would read it. We had the best time with that series, the best time. And I was thinking about that. And I was thinking about the story of Harry Potter, and I was thinking about the story of Exodus, because Harry Potter is a story about a young man singled out for a unique purpose and a unique time to rescue a unique people from a terrible plight. That sounded familiar to me. And then I began to think about our lesson for tonight, and it became even more familiar, because before he takes on this role as a leader for his people, what happened? Do you remember? He is rescued from certain death by the intervention of a parent. And then he is raised by a family that is not his own so that he can grow to adulthood safely. You know why I think that book is number three? Because it's a ripoff of number one. These stories that we are going to study have so much power over us as a collective human race. They are themes that resonate with us, themes of redemption, themes of deliverance. And so we see them everywhere. I read another interesting article this week that was advocating for the Bible to be taught in public schools on a secular level, because you cannot be a good student of Western literature if you don't know your Bible. So how great if, in addition to being a good student of the Bible, you were also a good student of literature when you got out of here. That would make me so happy as a former English major. So looking back at Exodus 1 tonight, think about that. Think about these huge sweeping themes that have colored not just the rest of the Bible, which they certainly do, but also the rest of literature from that point forward. So turn to Exodus chapter 1, and you saw in your homework this week that really Exodus was picking up the story from Genesis, right? And so we finished out in Genesis with the nation of Israel, such as they were. I mean, they weren't really a nation. They were just a family, right? It was 12 brothers. Joseph was sold into slavery into Egypt, but he had over time gained the trust of the Egyptian rulers and of Pharaoh himself. He rose to a place of prominence, and he became the method of deliverance for his other 11 brothers and their families. And so we begin Exodus chapter 1 with a reiteration of who it was that went into the land of Egypt. Why? Because this is going to be the story of who comes out of the land of Egypt. And so he's setting the stage. So it is several hundred years since the death of Joseph, and here we pick up the story. In your translation, it probably begins with the word these. These are the names of the sons of Israel. Am I right? But if you were to look at the original language, there is actually an and that has been pulled out of there. The first word of Exodus is and. And these are the names of the sons of Israel. Why? Because it is a continuing thought. You just finished reading Genesis, and now we're going to tell you what happens next. And these are the sons of Israel. Now, when we hear the word Israel, we think of the nation of Israel. But literally what he's saying in this first verse here is these are the sons of Jacob. Jacob, who was renamed Israel, okay? We will grow in our sense of, oh, Israel, the nation, Israel, the people group. But at this point, he's referring to, this is Israel or Jacob's family. These are their names. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. So you've got your 12 sons mentioned here, and then we have this number 70. There were 70 persons, and that matched the genealogy of 70 that was back in Genesis. Now, does that mean that there were 70 people total who went into Egypt? No, because those 70 people were representative. In fact, the number is highly significant. 7 and 10, two numbers that represent completeness. 7 times 10, 70. And so what was meant to be communicated was the entire complete number of Jacob's family that should have gone into Egypt did. Okay? And we'll see a similar number. We'll see a lot of numbers actually like that as we move through this book, and there are many in Genesis as well. And so in addition to these 70 names that are recorded, we know that there were also wives, there were also children, there were also servants, there were also livestock. And so there was a small crowd of people that moved into Egypt and settled in the land of Goshen, and they were herders in the land of Goshen. And so for many years, they were left to themselves. And in addition to that, for many years, God got a little quiet. He got a little quiet. We go from high drama and energy in the story of Joseph and the famines and all of that to this quiet several hundred years where they are herding animals in Goshen and apparently having babies left and right. And so in verse 6 it says, "Then Joseph died and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were," now let's count them, "fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them." Five different verbs in the original language that speak of the multiplication that has happened among these people. And when you looked in your homework this week, you looked back at where these ideas had occurred in Genesis as well as part of God's promise to make Abraham into a great nation, even all the way back to his promise to Adam and Eve that they would be fruitful and multiply. And so these words occurred in bits and pieces in all of those places, but it's not until we get to this verse that all of them are in the same verse. All of them. So the point for us to take from this is there has been a great deal of multiplying going on since the 70 people and their families came into Egypt. And then it was mentioned five times total, this idea of multiplying and growing, in the chapter itself. So it says the land was filled with them. Now the land that is being referred to there is probably the land of Goshen, because as we're going to see, they begin to cause dismay to the Pharaoh. He's worried about them, and then he's going to start dividing them up, spreading them out, putting them into service in other areas to try to break down the possibility that they could be a danger to him. So in verse 8, "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph." Now, what can we take from this phrase, "did not know Joseph"? Does it just mean that he'd never heard of him? No, I mean, it's pretty likely that he had heard of him. Joseph was in charge of pretty much everything in Egypt during the reign of the Pharaoh and pharaohs that he served under. And so it wouldn't have been that he physically did not know who he was. What we can take from this is that he did not see him as a reference point for how he would treat the Israelite people. So even though he probably knew that he existed, he had no relationship with him that he felt needed to be honored. And so this people that have lived in relative peace and quiet within the land of Egypt now can no longer rely on the favor of their host country, of their host ruler. He did not know him. He did not bear reference to his stature or his contributions. He does not respect where his place was in Egyptian society. So this Pharaoh said to his people in verse 9, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." So we hear some interesting things in this verse. First, there's a telltale phrase here in the beginning of verse 10. He says, "Come, let us." And then there is a statement that follows after that. If you are a student of the Old Testament, in fact, if you are a student of Genesis, you may recall that there was another person who made a similar statement, and that was the builder at the Tower of Babel. Come, let us build a tower that reaches to the heavens. This idea of self-determination, this idea that we are in charge, that we will make it the way we want it to be. And God's response at the Tower of Babel was, "Come, let us go down and see this thing that they have built." God is in charge. God ordains what happens. And so Pharaoh here, feeling very much in charge, "Come, let us deal shrewdly with them." And you looked in your homework at what shrewdly meant. A shrewd person is a person who, in any business dealings or in any dealings at all, is not looking for a win-win, is looking for a way to come out on top, even if the person that they're dealing with doesn't know it. A truly shrewd person will make you think that it is a win-win when, in fact, they have the upper hand. So he is suggesting not that they deal in a fair way, but that they deal in a shrewd way, a way in which they will come out the winners. "Lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies." So there's a geographical thing to understand here. The land of Goshen is to the north in Egypt. And so if Egypt were to be threatened by an attacking force, like the Assyrians or someone like that, they would be coming down from the north. And so let's say they get down, and the first place they hit is Goshen and the people of Israel. This is the seed that Pharaoh is planting in the hearts of his people. What if they join with them and they overthrow us and then they're out of here? So you can tell already, he does not want them to leave. He just wants them to be under his control. And that's a theme that we'll keep on seeing come up. So in verse 11, he says, "Therefore they," the Egyptians, "set taskmasters over them," the Israelites, "to afflict them with heavy burdens." They, the Israelites, built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, what happened? The more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. So now he's moved them around to build store cities for him. And so they're, instead of just being in the land of Goshen, now they're beginning to fill the land. And the harder he is on them, the more they keep cranking out the babies. So it says, "And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel." They were in dread of them. Why? Because within their own country, they are becoming what? A minority. Is this a familiar story? Of course it is. Okay, it says, "They were in dread of the people of Israel, so they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service." Remember that phrase there, "made their lives bitter." He is cueing you towards a future discussion that he will have in a few weeks. We'll get there. So the description of their hard service is that it was a bitter one. And they worked in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. Historical documents will tell us that the brick makers had the lowest job you can imagine in this society. It was a terrible job. Your clothes were stiff from the clay. Your fingers were worn down from the work. You came home exhausted at the end of the day and collapsed into your bed. Although in the case of the Israelites, apparently they still had a little energy left because they kept on having babies. Field work, not good. You know, the Nile is their source of life, and every year it would flood, and so they had an irrigation system that was basically, you had to pedal your foot to make the whole canal system work. And so these are the kinds of labor that would have been given to them. They basically make them the least members of society. It says, in all their work, at the end of verse 14, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. And so we have that repetition of the ruthless treatment that they receive at the hands of the Egyptians. And then we have this story. In verse 15, it says, then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, when you serve as a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live. So what is his ruthless solution to the population explosion and to becoming a minority in his own homeland? It is infanticide. But he has a certain way he plans to pull it off. He basically says to the Hebrew midwives, I want you to kill the male children, but I want you to do it in such a way that it doesn't look like I have ordered it. Basically, what he is asking these women to do is to, when a woman is delivering on the birth stool, and I'm reading this whole thing and I'm thinking, okay, wow, I am super glad that someone jammed a great big needle into my back and fed me ice chips and I got to watch TV. And I know if you live in Denton, you're like, what? This is the best thing ever. Get on a birth stool. But basically, these women, no offense, love you Denton people. The birth stool, the other term for it is on the bricks. So basically, it was two bricks and you sat on these bricks and you had a baby. And the midwife basically was the catcher, okay? And she caught the baby. And so what is being suggested here by Pharaoh is, think about what infant mortality was like at this point, okay? Women gave birth to stillborn babies all the time, or children died in childbirth. And so what Pharaoh is commanding that they do is, listen, if you see that it's a male child, you just kill it right then and there. We're good. Nobody needs to know. Nobody needs to know. And have you noticed something? We were just given the names of two women. Have you heard any other names in any of these tellings since we had the roll call for the family of Jacob? No, you have not, and you won't. The only two proper names that you will hear in this entire chapter are these two women, these two Hebrew midwives. Now, do you think that there were only two midwives to serve the entire Hebrew population who were popping out children left and right? No. The thinking is that these women were probably the guild leaders for the Hebrew midwives. They were the guild leaders, and so they were the ones who basically reported to Pharaoh. They had a certain status within the community, and so he goes to them and basically says, here is what you must do. Now, here's what we have to understand. In Egyptian society, Pharaoh was worshipped as what? A god. He was worshipped as a god. So as far as he is concerned, they have just received a command from God to go and do as he has said. But how do these two women respond? It says in verse 17, but the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. Now, listen to this. They should have feared Pharaoh, right? Because what do you think will happen to these women if they are caught not doing what he has told them to do? This man has the power of life and death over them. But they do not fear him. Why? Because they fear God. They are way less concerned with giving an account to Pharaoh and way more concerned with giving an account to a holy God. And so they do not do what he has asked. And then let's see what happens next. It says in verse 18, so the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and let the male children live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. Kapow, baby. Now, what just happened here? They lied, right? I mean, maybe it's a half-truth, because it does seem like these women are pretty good at having babies. So they have actually told a half-truth, but they have not told the whole truth, right? And yet we're going to see that God rewards them for their behavior. In fact, he doesn't just reward them a little bit. It says in verse 20, so God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied, there's that word again, and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Okay, that's an interesting point right there. He gave them what? He gave them families. So apparently the midwives did not have families prior to this. Do you know that scholars believe that the women assigned with the task of midwifery in this culture were women who were barren? So their job was to bring life into the world and hand it off to another woman. In a culture that valued for a woman above all else her ability to bear children. And so God's reward for their bravery is to bless them with children of their own. But they lied. And God rewarded it. How can we live with that? Do you remember in the New Testament how Jesus sums up the whole law? You know what he says? Someone says, what's the most important command? And he says, the first is this, you shall do what? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is this, you shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. This sums up the whole law. That's what he says. So that is the guiding principle behind the law. And how does Jesus spend his earthly ministry dealing with people who loved the law? He basically keeps saying to them, you love the letter of the law, but you don't love the spirit of the law. So in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, you think you are not guilty of murder because you haven't shoved a knife into somebody's back. But I'm telling you, you're committing character assassination every day. You think you're not guilty of adultery because you haven't slept with your neighbor's wife. But I'm telling you, every time you ogle her when she walks by, you've as good as done it in your heart. So he says to them again and again, godly obedience is not right actions. Godly obedience is right motives plus right actions. Your motives matter. What are the midwives' motives in lying to Pharaoh? To preserve life. In doing this, not only do they love the Lord their God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, but they love their neighbor as they love themselves. They have fulfilled the greatest command. So we see the story of Rahab later on in the Old Testament, and she too lies when they come looking to her and sends them off in the wrong direction, right? Do you remember that story? And she's commended as well. Why? Because we owe the truth to someone to whom the truth is owed. Does that make sense? If they tell the truth to Pharaoh, people die. And the same Ten Commandments that say, you shall not lie, say, you shall not lie. Murder. And so they say, what is the more important thing? What is the spirit of the law that is behind the letter of the law? And they step out in faith, and God rewards them because they valued life. They nurtured life. Such a unique and beautiful thing that women are called to do, especially. So let's see what Pharaoh does next. Verse 22. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. So he basically says, all right, we will murder them outright. I will place the chore in the hands of my own people. They will be drowned in the very water which brings life to us. It will become the water of death to them. But what is he? Doesn't kill the girls. Did that get on your nerves a little bit? I mean, you read this kind of stuff and you're like, well, okay, I guess I'm glad that you didn't want to kill the girls too, but why just the boys? What's the point there? What do you think he was thinking? Women are no threat. Daughters are no threat to me. In fact, I can probably use them for my advantage because we can have them be slave wives. They can intermarry with my people, and who knows, maybe we'll start to multiply because these women are strong. And also, we can use them as house servants. And they're not going to get into an uprising. They're not going to do anything to shake the balance. They're women. Daughters are not a threat to anyone. We'll see how that pans out. So I have a question for you. Who thwarted the plans of Pharaoh? That was in your homework. Who thwarted the plans of Pharaoh when it came to infanticide? Was it the midwives? Sure. But ultimately, it was God. It was God who thwarted the plans of Pharaoh. The only two people named in this whole chapter are these two women, these simple, everyday women who rise up in an act of civil disobedience that preserves a nation. Because did you know that 80 years from now, 600,000 men of adult age walk out of Egypt? How many of them were saved by the agency of these women on this day, at this time? We can guess that Moses was one who was saved through this because he's telling us this story. And they're the only two people whose names are memorialized. Why? Because God preserves the names of those who fear them, and he blots out the names of those who do not. Simple women standing in courage, standing in the gap for the innocent and the powerless. So let's see where we go from there. Chapter 2. Another chapter that has very few names in it. And so you got to go and do your homework and figure out who these people were that were being referred to. Who is the one name that is mentioned in chapter 2? It's Moses. And what is the point of that? To draw our attention to the significance of what is going on here. Focus your attention on Moses. Moses is the center of this part of the story. Let's see what happens with Moses. You're probably familiar with this story, this kind of a theme in a lot of fairy tales. It'll say, once upon a time in a land far, far away, there was a castle where a king and a queen lived, and they had a princess, and she was born to them, and her name was Snow White, or whatever her name is. Okay, and so they wait, and they give you the most important name at the right time in the narrative. That's what Moses is doing here. He wants to draw your attention to the central figure. So it says in chapter 2, verse 1, now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. So think about what things are like in Egypt at the time that this is happening, and hear the deliberate phrasing in this sentence. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife. What an act of courage, even to get married at this time. What an act of, it's an act of defiance in and of itself. I will do this. You will not frighten me. I will go forward. I will fear God more than I will fear Pharaoh. So he goes and takes as his wife a Levite woman. We learned that his name is Amram and her name is Jochebed. It says in verse 2, the woman conceived and bore a son. Can you imagine what they thought? And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months, the longest 3 months of her life. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. Now, what riverbank do we think this is? That would be the Nile. The Nile where he is to be drowned. And so it says that she takes a basket and she covers it with bitumen and pitch. Did that make anybody think of another story? The story of Noah's Ark. This word basket here is the word teva, T-E-V-A-H, and it means ark or casket. It occurs 28 times in Scripture. 26 of them are found in the account of Noah and the ark, and the other two are found right here in the story of Moses being placed in the Nile. So she took for him an ark or a casket made of bulrushes, and she daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank, and his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. What will be done to him? If I keep him, he dies. If I place him in this basket, at least I don't have to watch it. And who knows? Who knows? Who knows? So she places him in there, and they push him out into the water that was to drown him, the water that no doubt had drowned many of his contemporaries. And in verse 5 it says, now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket, the ark, the casket among the reeds, and sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Oh, man, Pharaoh is in big trouble. He has way underestimated the heart of a woman, hasn't he? He has way underestimated, because even in her words, you can tell she's not on board with this plan. Oh, it's one of the Hebrew babies. She's acknowledging he's supposed to be dead right now. He's supposed to be dead right now. And yet, what are we going to see? We're going to see him pass safely through the waters of death and be restored to life. Just like Noah's Ark. Just like the New Testament tells us is a picture of our baptism. That we are buried with Christ and raised to walk in new life. This is a picture of resurrection. So it says that his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" So this is Miriam, right? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother, Jochebed, who by rare coincidence was happening to wait nearby. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because she said, "I drew him out of the water." So there's a little bit of a wordplay that goes on here with Moses' name. The name Moses is actually, it's an Egyptian name, but it also has a fit for the Hebrew as well. And so she's kind of toying around with that a little bit. The names of some of the pharaohs were Amos or Tutmos. And so they had that word Mos in there, which meant son of. So it's kind of like Johnson or something like that, where we would tack it on. And so it's basically like saying, "This is my son." But it also means to draw out. And so unwittingly, Pharaoh's daughter gives to Moses a name that references not just the way that he was drawn from the water, but also the way that he will draw out a people from bondage to the purposes that God has for them. I love these chapters because in them there are no fewer than 5 women behaving bravely. 5 women. The story of Exodus will be a story about Moses, who is a strong deliverer, who is set apart for a purpose, who goes and rescues a people from bondage. That's what this book tells us, that Israel was delivered by a man named Moses. But first, it tells us that Israel was delivered, quite literally, by women. Women who feared the one true God more than they feared Pharaoh. Israel's first deliverer was not a man in a flowing robe with a streaming beard and a miraculous sign. Israel's first deliverer was a group of women in humble garb with streaming tears, no doubt, and a miraculous courage. The first Israelites to say enough to Pharaoh were women. In Genesis chapter 1, when we finally get to day 6 that we've all been waiting for in the creation story, because after all, isn't it the most important day when God creates man and woman? And it says that he created them, male and female, he created them. In his image, he created them. You and I, as women, bear the image of God uniquely in a way that men cannot. That's going to look a little different for each of you. It does not mean that you all have to be a stay-at-home mom who homeschools and blah, 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 and whatever the checklist is that's popular out there in Christianity today. It can look many ways, but there are certain ways that it does tend to look. Women are life givers. Whether you ever bear a child on your own, we have in us this thing where we give life and we nurture life to those around us. And in this way, we uniquely bear the image of God in a way that men just usually don't. This is why when you get together with your Sunday school class or your home group, who is it that goes, where are we all going to sit? Shouldn't we? Let's organize the food. Is it usually the guys? Now, I'm not saying there's not like some random guy out there who's really into all that, and that's totally fine. Hear me say that. In fact, I would probably be looking for that. But typically, it is the woman who says, now, what are we going to do with the kids during that time? Or what, you know, how's, we're looking for ways to make life happen. We're looking to write the note in the lunchbox. We're looking to send the encouraging note to a mother or to a sister or to a friend. We are looking for life-giving ways to be. It is a unique thing that God has given to us as women. And it is celebrated here in large letters at the beginning of the book of Exodus. And I love that. Don't do away with the daughters. They're not going to be a threat. We'll just keep them. And yet, it is a daughter who pulls Moses from the river. It is a daughter of Pharaoh himself who takes the child in. Each of you has a role to play in delivering the lost and the bound to freedom. You are life givers and you are life nurturers. Celebrate that. Look for how that looks in your life. You are a mother, you are a daughter, you are a sister, you are a niece, you are an aunt, you are a friend, you are a coworker, and in all of these spheres, there is something you can do to share the light of the gospel, to bring hope and healing. So we begin Exodus with a beautiful picture of these women. And what I love the most about it is the way that they had behaved. Did you see what they were characterized by? These were women who saw a need. They heard the cry of the baby, and they acted. They see and they hear and they act. And Pharaoh's daughter, what did she do? She adopted. See, hear, act, adopt. You watch in the next couple chapters of Exodus and you see if that isn't exactly what our Heavenly Father is going to do. Let's pray. Father, we thank you. We thank you for this beautiful story tonight. We thank you for the unique calling on women to bear your image, and we pray that you would work that out for us in our lives. We confess to you that we don't always know what that looks like. There are things that our culture says it looks like. There are things that our budget and our finances tell us that it has to look like. There are things that whether or not we can have children or we want children, all of those things tell us that it should look like. And we ask, Father, that you would sort through those things, that we would not look